We would much rather engage in intellectual calisthenics that lead us toward rational disobedience rather than to embody the simple message of Christ. We privilege our categories over the conviction that accompanies the spirit of love, that is the spirit of Christ.
That's the Reverend Adam Mixon. And today, he brings you a message entitled, Who is My Neighbor? I'm Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to episode 4190 of Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Friends, I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim, and today on Day One, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Adam Mixon, Senior Pastor of Zion Spring Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, where he has served faithfully for over two decades. Ordained in the National Baptist Convention, Reverend Mixon brings more than 30 years of pastoral experience to the pulpit, having served in numerous denominational leadership roles, and he has mentored emerging ministers across Alabama and beyond. A graduate of the University of Cincinnati, Samford University, and Beeson Divinity School, he also serves on the staff of the Ministry Collaborative. Adam Mixon, what a joy to have you here. Welcome to Day One.
I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you.
Adam, you stand out as someone who holds the prophetic and the pastoral so darn well, in my opinion, in truth-telling and gracious love offering and doing both of those things so well. And also, you do it bivocationally. And I feel like we do not talk about this enough in ministry and in just the world of what Christian church is these days. Would you say a bit about your ministry context and being bivocational?
Yeah, I have been serving the same church for 24 years.
24?
Yeah, here in Birmingham, Alabama. And for the length of that time, I've worked a job and served the church. And, you know, contrary to popular belief, there's no such thing as part-time ministry. So I've had two full-time jobs for the last 24 years. I think that is very much, it's not exceptional.
And right.
Yeah. It's a lot of folks in my contacts have been doing this for generations, and it just so happens that that way is becoming the way. If you're discerning any type of call and you love God, you love the church, you love his people, in some ways you're gonna have to learn how to make some tents. You're gonna have to learn how to do something else while you are serving the church, or you won't be serving the church.
Yeah. Like leadership and being a Christian clergy person, pastor, preacher, priest, all of those things, especially, I mean, around the globe, like mm-hmm. the different ways that Christianity manifests, it's actually more and more the exception that, like, all right, this church has all the salary to pay for this pastor's full salary and help them enough so that they are paying for off their student debt and providing for their family and health insurance. And I mean, it's real. And it's an important aspect of the way we do church, and it's shifting, like, kind of questioning what we believe about it. Like, is church an employed full-time pastor all the time, or is church people who come together, love God, figure out what it means to be Christian, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what, I've worked with a couple of cohorts of seminarians who are starting at that journey, mm-hmm. and I've been fortunate to come to on the tail end when they're getting ready to finish, like, their MDiv and are thinking about what's next. And I've just started doing gut checks with these folks. Like, at the front door, I'm like, look, if you have this deep sense of calling, mm-hmm. and you love God, you love his people, you want to serve the church, I need you to understand that this expensive theological education that you are paying for, You're not going to make that up on the back end. So you're going to have to think about, you know, how deep is this calling really? Will you do it if there is no package? Will you do it if the money does not match those student loan payments? It's a gut check. And yeah. There are some people who shrug and think I'm blowing smoke, but then, you know, they find out real quick, like, oh, this is what you were talking about. But I think there's some benefit in it. I mean, there's the immediate challenge, and yes, it is taxing, but there's a way to do it in a way that I think is healthy. I do try to model and encourage that. We've just had a cohort wrap up. Actually, it wraps up this month that was focused solely on those who were given to, we call it multivocational ministry, and offering support to those pastors in that context. But it is very much the way it is. Yeah.
Yep, the way it is, for sure. And it's just increasingly important conversations to be having.
And can I add just one thing to that?
Yeah.
One of the great benefits for me has been that it's kept me from that kind of insulated, isolated, because, you know, we can get locked off into our institutions and we can, you know, it's very different when you are going to work every day and dealing with the same kind of stuff, whether it's in a corporate job or in manufacturing or the service, you're having to live, work alongside. There's already a distance between the pulpit and the pew.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's going to be there no matter what because I found that distance shrinks.
In a good way. Yeah.
In a good way that kind of gets us off our perch and instills a bit more patience and compassion and greater understanding.
Yeah. Well, and from that perch of your pulpit specifically, you are committed to both deep theology and grassroots activism. What are some examples of how those streams are converging meaningfully for you in your context in Birmingham?
I think in ministry in a very big way, staying proximate, paying attention to where you are, staying present where you are, doing the good that you can immediately is super important, while at the same time challenging the powers that be to do the right thing. In my context, it's always two conversations. On the one hand, you're guiding people or discipling people to a deep, rich, meaningful relationship with Jesus through community, but at the same time, that doesn't solve all of the ills, right? There are poor people who are marginalized, who didn't create the environments that they were born in, that are oppressive. You can't just tell them, well, just be faithful and it'll all get better and blah, blah, blah. And if you just, you know, that's noble, but it's wrongheaded. It's too little.
Piety doesn't end suffering.
That's right. We should be advocating for transforming systems that create poverty and oppression. So on the one hand, I'm like, hey, y'all, you need to do what's right by these people. And then to my folks in particular, there's always a conversation like, look, don't get embroiled in this system.
Yep.
You know, keep trying, keep pressing, and then having to show up when people are trying and hitting barriers and then walking with them through it. It's messy. It's time consuming. My family has sacrificed a lot because of those types of demands, but it's the work.
It is the work. And it is the witness too. I mean, but it doesn't make it easy. Woof. Mm-mm, mm-mm,
mm-mm. Now listen for God's word as we hear from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 10, verses 25 through 37.
And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said to him, What is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, You've answered correctly. Do this, and you shall live. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, And who is my neighbor? Jesus replied, A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was. And we saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, The one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said to him, You go and do likewise.
Now, Reverend Adam Mixon's sermon, entitled, Who is My Neighbor?
In this sermon today, we will center ourselves on verse number 29 in the 10th chapter of Luke. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, And who is my neighbor? When we think about naming and labeling, I recall how God gave Adam the job of naming what he created in the creation myth in Genesis 2. This naming was not just a vocabulary challenge or an exercise in creative play, but it was an exercise in dominion. In the same way, whether we're talking about a doctor diagnosing an ailment or a chemist identifying the elements that make up some compound, the process of naming or classifying determines how a thing is treated or handled. It's a potent exercise and indeed a very dangerous one when we begin to direct this power toward people and people groups. And who is my neighbor? This religious man, desiring to justify himself, asked Jesus, Who is my neighbor? But in peeling back the layers, I found another question beneath the surface. That is, who am I to treat with regard as I would a neighbor? That is, who is it that I am commanded to love as I love myself? This religious man asked the question in an attempt to justify himself. And though seemingly innocuous, this question is a dangerous question of classification that seeks to determine the categories to which we assign people, and subsequently the standards whereby we determine what treatment and behavior is appropriate for and of them. This dangerous question of classification, this labeling, the titles we render, if we're honest about it, these are not just titles, but they are meant in some way or another to define value, honor, or dishonor for someone or something. And Jesus answers this religious man's question with a story. In a demonstration of homiletical genius, he replies to this seemingly profound theological question with a simple, albeit provocative, parable that has come to be known as the parable of the Good Samaritan. The name in and of itself is paradoxical and ironic, a firm reminder of the strange and mysterious ways in which divine providence presents herself in our experience. Jesus speaks of a man robbed, stripped, beaten, and left for dead on a roadside. He speaks of the priest, the Levite, taking turns ignoring this poor one's condition. And then he raises an unlikely hero, a Samaritan, a type of Christ who not only sees this poor one's condition,
but is moved with compassion to do something about it. We see an unlikely hero who is moved with compassion, but who also risks comfort and safety for the sake of another. Encounter the actions of one despised by any good Jew who invests time and resource in addressing the needs of another's present well-being and their future care. We encounter an anti-hero whom we would rather ignore than imitate. Who is my neighbor? Jesus answers this religious man's question with a story. Makes me wonder, what stories might we tell to elucidate the simplicity of the gospel in a clear and an accessible way with both conviction and compassion? But I digress. Who is my neighbor? Within our current social political context here in America, the questions of access to aid, human services, refuge, safety, and dignity are now hinging on how we respond to this question. But I would add that these current crises are not really new ones. The history of our nation, at least here in America, is marred by the moral failures of both individuals and institutions, church and state alike, that have not embodied the heart of what it means to be a good neighbor. In much the same way as the lawyer in the text, we, that is, those of us who are part of this religious establishment, would much rather label people than love them. And what we would much rather engage in intellectual calisthenics that lead us toward rational disobedience rather than to embody the simple message of Christ. We privilege our categories over the command to compassion. We privilege our categories over the conviction that accompanies the spirit of love, that is, the spirit of Christ. And then, very personally, I've encountered the burden of being misjudged based on stereotypes related to my appearance. Black and male, certain size and stature, you must be an athlete. You're threatening, you're aggressive, you're intimidating. I've encountered countless insults to both my intelligence and my humanity from teachers, police officers, salespeople, restaurant servers, loan officers, professors, doctors, preachers, and even some good church folks. Sometimes even folks that look just like me. I've endured both left-handed compliments and liberal well-intendedness that would identify me as exceptional or so articulate, despite their limited relationships and exposure to so-called people like me. But then I've also encountered how quickly I can slip from victim to offender when I encounter someone from outside my own circle or community. How I can so quickly become judgmental or dismissive while presenting a veneer of compassion, civility, and authenticity. I've been regularly humbled at my own hypocrisy. The number of times I've been so consumed by my own duties that I deny compassion to someone so obviously placed in my way. It makes me ashamed. The number of times that I've justified this behavior because I made a judgment. I applied a label or I made a decision about someone's worth without getting close enough to them to see them, that is, to really see them. So then it's not from some moral high horse that I offer a critique of the church, but it is with utmost humility and with deep love that I call out in the church what Jesus calls out in this religious man in this parable. The simple truth is that the church in America has failed to embrace this message of neighborliness. There is no greater witness than our current social political climate. Yes, there have been momentary corrections and myriad efforts by well-meaning individuals and institutions have sought to address our nation's ills with charity. But this charity, as we have exercised it, is a poor substitute for the love and justice that makes such charity unnecessary. And as a result, the world watching stumbles at our faulty witness. You see, our identity as Christians, as the church, is bound, as Dr. King would say, to our relationship with God the Father through Christ. But it's also inextricably linked to our relationship with one another. Without dereliction or discrimination, our foremost and most consequential efforts must be toward full expression of our love for God through our love for our neighbors. The identity and witness of the church in many ways are affirmed or undermined on how we level and answer this important question: who is my neighbor? We simply cannot profess love for God while debasing, degrading, dismissing, or disregarding one another. We cannot be good neighbors by being passive witnesses to terrible acts against those created in the very image and likeness of God. We can't be good neighbors. We can't love others well while actively excluding and dissociating ourselves from those whom we have labeled as other. So how about we lose the labels and learn to love one another well, even as Christ loves each of us? Who is my neighbor? Who is worthy of love? Who deserves this grace? Who is worthy of dignity? On the one hand, my cynical mind would say none of us. We are all wretched. But then Jesus reminds me that this love is for every single one of us. Jesus answers this religious man's self-justifying question with a story, and he challenges the church today with the same. Who is my neighbor? That is, who is worthy of love and dignity? Who deserves compassion? Jesus says, everyone who needs it. Everyone who needs it. We're all poor and needy. Despite our wealth of position, we are all spiritually and morally bankrupt, bereft of hope. We need this compassion. We need this love. And as we receive it freely by the grace of God, may we offer it to others. May we offer to others that which we covet for ourselves. And behold, the lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said to him, What is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, You've answered correctly. Do this, and you will live. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, And who is my neighbor? Jesus replied, A man is going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him, departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road. He saw him, he passed on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him
and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him. And whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Which of these three, Jesus asked, do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said to him, you go and do likewise. This is God's word for his people.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Adam Mixon. For a free transcript of his sermon, Who is My Neighbor?, you can visit us online at dayone.org. Each week, we take a moment to say thank you. This gratitude moment lifts up one of you, our faithful listeners who walk this journey with us. Today, we thank Carol Morgan of Annapolis, Maryland, for her generous gift in memory of her husband, Bill Morgan. Bill was an early leader in the Day One ministry whose legacy continues to shape this program today. The Morgans lived for many years in Atlanta, where Bill served in leadership roles throughout the Episcopal Diocese, including as chair of Episcopal Charities Foundation and as a mentor to the Lost Boys of the Sudan. Carol, we thank God for you and for Bill. Your support for this ministry is such a blessing. If someone in your life has inspired your faith, consider honoring them as Carol has, through a gift to Day One that keeps their spirit shining. For 80 years, Day One has shared messages that connect, uplift, and unite Christians across traditions. To support this ministry, visit dayone.org/donate. Or mail your contribution to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia, 30319. At a time when the world longs for wisdom, unity, and faith, your support makes it possible for Day One to continue lifting up powerful preaching and theological conversation. Next week on Day One, we are thrilled to welcome the Reverend Rob Webb, Director of the Rural Church Program at the Duke Endowment. In Rob's sermon, Truth Shared in Song, get ready for a fresh window on the way that music, especially singing and sacred songs, help us really hear and know God in unexpected ways. How can music help us hold fast to the truth? Well, come hear all about it. That's next week on Day One. Adam, thank you so much for that. Oh, how are we with our neighbor and who is our neighbor? I mean, I'm just so glad you zoom in on it too, because it's plenty for one. You could do a whole year of sermons on it. I mean, man.
Yeah, my congregation would hate me for it, but yeah.
What would your congregation say? They'd be like,
We get it. Move on.
Here's one thing that, you know, tying back to what we were talking about before in terms of acting locally and being present, what governs us, what holds us together as a multi-religious, multicultural society is that we share certain principles. But one of them has to be that each of us is valuable and even sacred. Mm-hmm. Great. We all get that. And even capitalism gets that. Like, okay, yep, good. You are an important little producer and consumer. But then the one that really tips the apple cart over and it gets this neighbor thing is that we belong to each other. That we are not just little nodes who bump into each other or are connected or we're household groupings or we're economic little bots, but like we belong to each other. If we belong to each other, what does that mean?
My goodness. I think of MLK's quote about us being inextricably woven together in a web of mutuality or something like that.
Yeah.
That we can't escape one another.
No.
And when we do, or when we try to, it's bad for all of us. There's the moral injury that it causes those of us who ignore or disregard, or but then there's the real injury that those who we objectify or marginalize or neglect suffer. It's just an endless cycle of suffering. And gosh, if we could just rip the cover off of that and say, look, as I go, so do you.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we love each other because we are called to do so, because that's how we're made. And to be seen and known authentically for who we particularly are is so important.
But then again, I think there's such beauty in the passage that we have for this message, that those simple words about the Samaritan seeing him and being moved with compassion. And for me, and this is, you know, call it my sanctified imagination or whatever, when it says it sees him and he's moved with compassion, I feel like the Samaritan looks at that man and says, that could be me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Right. That seeing is much more than just realizing someone's condition, but realizing again that bond that is between us. All of these folks in this passage were on the same road.
Yeah, they were on the same road.
That's what they held in common. They were traveling on this same road, but only one of them realized that, you know what, I'm sharing this journey.
Yeah.
And was moved with compassion. It's fascinating. I remember unpacking this passage with a group of preachers, and I just marveled at how our social location kind of influenced what we encountered when we entered into the passage.
Oof.
I remember walking a group through and nobody mentions the road or the setting, right, as being central to the story.
Interesting.
Which was fascinating. Again, and this is probably 15 or 20 pastors. Nobody mentions the road. Nobody mentions the robbers as people.
Isn't that, because we are bound up with them as well.
Yep.
Some of us are called to go attend to holding the robbers accountable, but also to loving them too.
Why are they robbing people on this
road?
There's that. Nobody talks about the innkeeper. There are all of these places and people that we don't see.
Yep.
That we neglect to see. And of course, all of us want to be the Samaritan, but
of course we do. Yeah. And we feel, and then there's the layers of like, when have I failed to be the Samaritan? Maybe you were the innkeeper. Maybe, you know what I mean? And sometimes you are sometimes you don't even realize you're the one that needs to be helped. There's that.
And that's the oddness of the story, right? Everybody's like switching places all the way through. All of us are needy.
Exactly.
All of us are the ones beaten and broken. Some of us bear our wounds externally. Some of us have resource and walls and wealth to hide behind but we're all poor and needy, and we need to learn how to see each other.
Yes. It seems to me sometimes that one could argue that it's easier to hide and to insulate more than it ever has been. And I don't know. I'm just thinking about loneliness too, for some reason, which isn't in the passage, but it's real and it's dangerous.
Yeah,
and,
you know what? I don't discount that. I think it's there. The man is left beaten, stripped,
yeah,
half dead. He's alone.
Yeah,
he's alone. And each of those who journeyed on that up the road, each of them in some respect or another, were traveling alone.
Yep.
The priest didn't have a cadre with him, nor did the Levite. They were walking up the same road alone.
Yep.
Impacted differently, I guess, by circumstance. But there's something to that aloneness. I think it's Bell Hooks who says, none of us heal in isolation. We are not well when we're isolated. And that goes for the priest, the Levite. It goes for the man beaten. It goes for the Samaritan. We don't do well when, again, we're not connecting, when we don't see one another. Yeah.
And the very things that can keep us unwell and broken, like chronic pain and chronic illness, addiction, being really having caretaking duties that keep you just stuck to the person you're taking care of, and it, like, your world gets really tiny. Going through really difficult relationship abuse. I mean, there's just, the list goes on and on. There's a lot of ways to suffer, and goodness, we're not meant to do it alone.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even, you know, to the other side of that, the pressure of celebrity or public life, you know, there's the in a room, but all alone with the crowd around you, that constant. There's so much. Again, all of humanity is suffering with the same condition. The way it manifests is different, you know, based on our social location, but we're all poor. We're all needy. Some of us are deluded.
There's right? that.
about our neediness, but we're all in trouble. We're all in trouble if we're left alone. I think every one of us wants to be seen. But sometimes we want what we're not willing to offer.
Ooh. Sometimes we want what we're not willing to offer others. Oh.
So if the desire is to be seen, then see. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, my theology kind of dictates that there's no such thing as an accident. There's no coincidence, no such thing as luck or happenstance. It is all providence at work.
Yeah.
I don't pass by that cashier or by that kid on the corner. That doesn't happen accidentally. But am I seeing?
Yeah.
Am I paying attention? Am I staying present enough? Am I being vulnerable enough to look in somebody's eyes and see that it's not well with them and not look away? Because, I mean, you know, that makes us uncomfortable. Staring at somebody and paying attention, your eyes lock, which one of us is going to break first? Which one of us is going to look away first? It's the seeing and being seen that terrifies us. So we throw up masks and again, whatever reason we have for donning those masks, whatever protective reasons we have for doing that, they end up imprisoning us, again, further isolating us and keeping us from being who we were created to be.
I love it. I love, too, thinking about how I know when I hear something or I happen to press play on a thing and I'm like, oh, geez, I need to hear this today. So, may the gift of your sermon hit the ears it needs to hear, Adam. And we love having you on day one. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a privilege. Thank you, Katie.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays. And we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media, You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. May the grace of God be with you on day one and every day yet to come.